welcome to Influential Visions. Here, we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. My name is Nathaniel Schooler, and I am your host today. Today, I am joined by Chief Science Officer at Hypergiant, Christina Libby, and she's also an author and an adjunct professor at NYU. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So we're going to talk about AI, machine learning, and COVID-19, obviously, and the future of warfare, which is something that you know a lot about, right? Because you spend a lot of time thinking about these things.
It's been a huge amount of time thinking about these things, all of these things, and sort of how do they work together. Although COVID-19, literally only in the past 6 weeks, but everything else a lot of the time.
Of course, of course. So what's actually happening then with COVID-19 and AI and machine learning, and how are those things kind of working to help us to get out of this situation we're in?
So I think there's actually a lot of things that are interesting. There was a report put out by the UN and the WHO and a bunch of other smart people in the medical space maybe 2 or 3 days ago. Anyways, that's largely irrelevant. That was talking about machine learning and COVID. And they actually broke it down into 3 areas that I thought were really interesting. So one was about how do you actually look at the spread of the pandemic? So how do you identify and track? And sort of one sector. The second sector was how do you actually isolate the virus, look at it from a molecular perspective and figure out what is it doing? What is it made of? How do you stop it? And then the third part they were looking at was societal, right? So what is the impact of the epidemic on society? And then they looked at a part of it that was also interesting called infodemics, which is a term I had never heard before and was curious if they had made up. But infodemics is about the spread of the information, so largely the propaganda part of it. And they were looking at AI applied across those different industry sectors. And I think the biggest thing for us to think about is the fact that we're not there yet, right? All of the sort of AI machine learning things that have been used in the moment are wonky, right? Because we're sort of just pulling together things and being maybe we can solve for this problem. And then we're really, really rushing forward to try and solve it in a bunch of different areas at once. So I think people who are AI and machine learning, and this is going to be what's going to solve the pandemic, it's pretty short-sighted, right? Because we don't have the solutions. And so the biggest learning or sort of interesting thing for, I think, from this moment is how do we prepare for the future, right? How do we make sure that there are companies who have these big remits to sort of think about preparing for, solving for, resolving for pandemics? And how do we make sure that we're funding those people so that the next time this happens, because it's going to happen, it's probably going to happen more often than we want to have it happen in the future. How do we make sure that we have companies in place to do it rather than a bunch of sort of researchers who are running at it and a bunch of entrepreneurs who are running at it? And we're all trying really hard, but I just think it's extremely messy.
Yeah. It's certainly very messy. I was reading something about it the other day. I've been reading a lot from MIT actually on the whole sort of side of things, because I've subscribed to their
coronavirus theory.
Yeah. I've been reading a lot from MIT, and it's they're thought leaders really in all of this kind of tech. And I just find the whole thing very worrying, really. I mean, if you look at how quickly it spread and everything. But there are lots of other things we can sort of talk about. International security was something that I wanted to quiz you about, because I know you're big into security. And we've got some massive risks, haven't we, really, in terms of the way the world works. So what's your take on that one?
Yeah, so I think there's really interesting things connected to the pandemic that we're not quite talking about yet. And from an AI perspective or machine learning perspective, we also haven't modeled out, right? So there's a lot of interesting people making models for the spread of the pandemic, right? Like, we have the Johns Hopkins graph, which is indicating hotspots. We have a bunch of researchers, and like largely out of China, who've made sort of these variant different predictive models. There was really good research out of the UK on predictive models as well. And that's good, right? But as we look towards the entirety of our social structure, there are a bunch of different systems that prop it up, right? Healthcare is a system. It is the system that is in crisis at the moment, but it's one pillar, one system, right? So a huge amount of people are going about their regular jobs in the way that they always have, right? Because they're not impacted by that pillar and they're not impacted by the quarantine. There are lots of people who've lost their jobs because of quarantine, and that's a system concern we need to think about as well. But like, so far, one system. I'm not that concerned about one system breakdown within the entirety of the international system, right? Because that is manageable in the same way that it is manageable to fight a war on one front. The moment you have wars on multiple fronts, it's much harder to fight a collective front war, right? Because then you have to start to figure out how do you disperse essential resources across a variety of different fronts. So when we look at the pandemic, we're putting a ton of frontline resources there, right? Cops, the National Guard in the US, and military in other places. Our military is preparing for it as well. And everyone is rushing towards that one fire. But then we are seeing things like in New York City, there's a massive uptick in police officers who have corona. When we look at the military, we look at a much more aggressive spread of corona because people are simply closer together, right?
Okay.
So when we look at another pillar start to crumble, say the economy, right? In the last week, 3 million people filed for unemployment in the US. And so
we are
starting to see a strong crumble of that economic vector. What happens when the economy crumbles is people can't feed themselves. People can't feed their children. People can't pay their rent. So people are driven out of their homes to seek like essential necessities. And that leads to crime, right? And it leads to violence. And if the people who generally address crime and violence are looking at a different space, i.e. trying to ensure people are stay quarantined, or if they're coming into contact with people who are quarantine victims at a really high level, then they no longer are also able to start to deal with this rise in crime. So as we see a rise in crime and violence, now we have sort of big three impacts on our overall social structure. And that's when I'm really worried about sort of like mass scale violence and decay. And we're starting to see pockets of increase in violence. We're starting to see that a little bit in New York. We're starting to see there was a big art crime that happened over the weekend. I think a lot of people saw the footage of the police officers hitting people extremely violently in Kenya who were trying to get onto the ferry. What happens is when we have these increases in violence, we also have so much pent up fear and grief and anger about the entire sort of chaos of the global system that it's quite hard for that to sort of like spur into violence. Like, I think we're in quite a tinderbox situation at the moment. So I'm in Manhattan now. But before I was here, I was in Rwanda for 2 weeks. And there was a week and a half ago. And I was in Rwanda, I was watching the situation, and I thought, you know what, I think I'm just going to stay in Africa for another couple of weeks. I'm going to let the hysteria die down in New York, and then I'm going to come back. And on Sunday night, that seemed fine. I switched my ticket. I was going to come back on April 4th, so this coming weekend. Mm-hmm. And then on Monday morning, I started to watch the news, and I was like, this doesn't feel like it's going the way that it seemed to be going on Sunday, right? And so by Monday night, I was like, no, I need to get out of Rwanda because so my master's degree is in international security. I studied genocide pretty extensively and exclusively. And Rwanda is 30 years out from the Rwandan genocide. that's still a lot of grief and emotion and complexity that is part of any society that has gone through a large amount of wide-scale violence, right? And it doesn't take a huge amount of external chaos or sort of dislocation to increase the level in acceptable violence, right? And so for me, it was too much of a risk as someone who's not African, who doesn't necessarily spend a huge amount of time in Africa, who doesn't know how to operate in that system, to stay in Africa anymore. So I came back to the US, and in the US, we have so many contextual historical problems that we have never dealt with in any way that are just simmering below the surface. And I think the pandemic is so exacerbating here as well, a lot of those conditions that lead to violence, or a lot of those conditions that lead to inequality, that lead to anger, that lead to sort of all of these emotions that we just as a society sort of gloss over, that if a lot of people who constantly feel uncared for, they feel like they live in a world full of inequality, they feel like they don't have resources for them, now find themselves in a world where everyone they know is dying because they can't get to hospitals, they can't get any tests, they no longer have food, they no longer have an income stream, all of these options. It makes so much sense that that devolves into violence. And then when we have all of this internal violence and strife in different countries, is a perfect opportunity for bad actors of any sort to further exacerbate that level of chaos. And I think we're already seeing it largely from a cybersecurity perspective, in which we've seen a big uptick in violence. We've seen a huge uptick in attacks based around Corona. And we've already seen an uptick in a lot of propaganda from Russia in an intent to sort of further destabilize the global information and economic structure. So that was a very long answer to your question, but I think it's really interesting to think about that, and then to layer on this sort of opportunity. I think there's a lot of opportunity for sort of machine learning and predictive systems that could help to predict that work. The problem is, I don't think we spend a lot of time modeling multi-system failures in efforts to sort of predict large-scale social and systematic failure. And so it would be largely impossible for us, or not impossible, but there's not a lot of resources and time and energy being put there because there's not as much as big economic upside for those types of companies at the moment.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, completely. I mean, I've been giving this a lot of thought as well. And I've been giving it a thought. I've been thinking about Bangladesh, I've been thinking about India, I've been thinking about China, I've been thinking about factory workers who are on very, very low wages. And I've been thinking, well, us in the West, we're not going to honor our commitments of purchasing. So what's going to happen is that these people who have earned very little money, don't have any savings, they are in essence going to starve to death. Potentially. And I'm very worried about it. And I know I shouldn't take the weight of the world on my shoulders, but like I kind of, you know, I'm not letting it depress me, but I'm fully aware that this is a potential issue that can happen. Yeah. Unless us as a global society put some money in a pot and we actually take this opportunity to do the universal basic income, which everyone's been talking about for the last however many years. And we could actually base that upon inflation in those countries, what people need. And we could actually turn around and create a completely different model that we're in and stop saying, well, I need the latest this, I need the latest that. And instead turn around and say, well, I'm going to buy this for the next, and I'm going to wear it for the next 10 years, or I'm going to buy this and I'm going to buy it from a charity shop, or I'm going to, you know, and these things are really important. We sit here in the West and we almost forget all about the global supply chain, and that's really a worry for me.
Yeah, I think experienced a large amount of guilt in leaving Rwanda because I felt like we're doing it again. Like, not that my like tourism in Rwanda could in any way save anyone from anything. I'm a relatively frugal tourist, but I felt I had this moment of like, well, we're just leaving, right? Like, and because I think I was part of a collective group of people and everyone was just leaving and going home.
Yeah.
And tourism is a massive part of the Rwandan economy, right? So that creates a massive destabilizing impact on creating a country of safety, right? I was looking at Nigeria recently closed its borders or is in the process of closing its borders. And looking at Nigeria, it's a massive destination for a huge amount of migrants, right?
Huge country, huge population.
But also a lot of people who make their money in Nigeria and anywhere in Africa and globally are doing it hawking things on the street, right? And there's a lot of those people are doing it to trade a piece of trash for something else that they can actually trade for a small amount of food, and they're living off that every day. I mean, here I have a pantry. I have enough food to last me for a month. I have Amazon Fresh delivery. I can afford it. And when we issue a stay-at-home order for someone who has nothing at home, we've ostensibly sent them on a death sentence, right? And so there is this question about how do we actually create global and societal norms? And what I think it comes down to that's really interesting is that, and it's a question I think about a lot in relation to thinking about colonization of space and thinking about sort of how do we engage in space, which is like, how do we think about humanity as a collective whole? And how do we actually sort of create normalcies or structures that benefit us as a general population? Because right now we're in a system, we're in a nation state situation, a nation state system, right? And that is all about economic power and military might for nations. A nation's goal isn't actually necessarily the protection of the people, it's the protection and the safeguarding of the nation, right? So the military isn't there to protect you, individual human. The military is there to shore up resources. The military is there to protect physical boundaries of a state, right? And so what we see in the situation of pandemic is we see an isolating and a condensing of people into a specific nation rather than sort of large scale addressing of basic social problems. And that I think is calling for this effort for people to really question and reckon with the societies or the social structures, the political and economic structures that make up what it means to be human. And that asks this big question, which is like, the system we live in is a moral reflection on how we view ourselves, right? And so a nation state, a capitalist nation state, is based on the assumption largely that we think the most power, like the highest achievement of human well-being is wealth, right? Like humans are here to make money, and that people who have more money are better humans. And so we look at something like universal basic income, and what that requires is sort of like a full-scale reevaluation of thinking about the sort of value of humanity and the moral position that we're interested in. Universal income means that we're making a decision that says it is best to spend our money on everyone because everyone is in some way valuable enough that we want to give them money in order to ensure their survival. That's actually not the system and the structure that we live in right now. We live in a structure that doesn't prioritize that. And so then you have this question about if we wanted to do something like create universal basic income, we also need to have a large scale reckoning about how we think of humanity, how we think of our collective value, how we think of our collective place in the universe, how we think of our collective, you know, sort of social mandate and mission. And that becomes something that people are really deeply uncomfortable with, right? Because we will get to people who capitalism serves them just fine, and they deeply and honestly think that the accumulation of personal wealth is the highest form of individual achievement.
Mm-hmm.
And so the universal basic income requires that we entirely shift that perspective on a global scale. And the question that comes to mind is, what is the crisis that's big enough that demands that level of social engagement and sort of like self-evaluation? Mm-hmm. And climate change wasn't enough, right? Like the threat to our entire planet was not enough to create that. Pandemic, possibly, it depends on how long it lasts, but I think largely wealthy people are very comfortable at the moment, so it's not enough for them.
Well, we're okay, the people who work from home. I mean, you know, exactly. We're okay, right? But yeah. Like it's the people who, you know, there are so many people who are struggling right now, right? It's just like but you know,
how much violence did they
Well, I don't know. I mean, you out there, yeah. Like if you're allowed to carry a gun, yeah, if you've got a private gun license to have a gun in your pocket and have a concealed weapon, you're actually automatically deputized by the government anyway. So you've got no problem, yeah, because you've got X amount of million people and you've got X amount of million guns, yeah. So the people who've actually been given the powers to carry concealed weapons will just act as deputies, yeah. So, you know, that's what's going to happen, yeah.
Maybe.
If
what
it gets to that stage.
Pardon? Right, right, we get to that. I mean,
otherwise they get their gun taken away from them. So, you know, do you want to have a gun or you don't?
How do you take someone's gun away at that
sooner
point?
Or later they'll get sooner or later they'll go and get it. But at the end of the day, right, it's a really big worry, all of this stuff. Yeah, yeah. So how are we going to use technology to in defense? That's my next talking point.
Yeah, so I think there's two things that are really interesting here, right? So one is, how do we use technology to change the structure so that we don't have to use more technology in sort of a defense infrastructure, right? Mm-hmm. And that is, there's a lot of different ways that we could use technology now to sort of like facilitate global conversation and engagement and sort of better predict and look at global problems, right? That's mm-hmm. like one of the interesting things for me about Hypergiant, where I work, is like that's the focus of the company, is like solving big future problems with technology. And like not being afraid to sort of take on such a big project, such a big effort, mm-hmm. right? And so sort of have this challenge to the technology industry, which is like, don't make another app. Like, don't make another Farmville app. Like, don't go out there and just sort of spend your time making bullshit things that make money. Take on big risks, right? Like, yeah. Actually try and solve massive, substantive human problems. Mm-hmm. And sure, maybe you'll kind of fuck it up, but like, sorry, I don't know if I can say that on the
You
podcast.
Did it, and I'm not gonna edit this.
Thank you. But like, try, right? And I think that's this problem with the technology industry, which is we can't just put our hands up and say, we're just making a tool. We're just making a platform. Because what we've seen time and time again is that we're never just making a tool or a platform. We're making things that change the way that society operates. And mm-hmm. so what we need to do is we actually need to ask the questions of society, how do we want to operate? We need to look to big thinkers. We need to look to politicians. We need to look to people who are deeply connected in the organization of the world and thinking about future iterations, and then ask, how do we apply this knowledge that we have, this technology knowledge, that in service of sort of these bigger problems and these big ideas? And in order to do that, we need a lot of government support. We need a lot more government technology industry interaction. Technology is not agnostic, and I think technologists who think that are just putting their heads in the sand, right? Like, yep. Even if we look at, I mean, a lot of technology inventions come because of science fiction writers. Science fiction writers are speculating on a different sort of version of the future. Mm-hmm. Technologists are in service of that vision, their vision. And so what we need to do is actually change that conversation so that we're thinking collectively, where do we want to go? Collectively, what do we want to do? And then how do we look at these industries, manufacturing, hospitality, technology, any of these industries, and put that against the mission? China does this very, very well. It has the benefit of being an authoritarian regime, and so it's able to make long-term plans and have people stick to these long-term sort of strategies and visions. But I don't think that is something that is impossible for a democratic country as well. What we have to do, though, is commit to sort of longer-term planning. So that's where we as an industry, I think, could become so much more effective and smart and sort of capable, which brings us to the question of technology in defense as well, right? So a lot of technology companies are unwilling to work with the Department of Defense, are scared to work with the Department of Defense. All that happens then is a bifurcation of development, right? And mm-hmm. and anytime we distance ourselves from the enemy, we start to other them in a way that means that we cannot, like, we can no longer sort of understand or empathize with them, right? Where they become like the bastion of all evil. What's happened with technology and defense is that there has been an othering of both industries to the way that that is how they think of each other, right? Instead of thinking about this idea of collectively, could we work together? Could more technology in the defense sector save lives? Could it help to create stronger national borders? Could it help to fund a lot more defense funding into technology advancements that sort of help us overall and from a holistic community perspective? There's a, like, that I think is the big question of the future of, do we decide to sort of pull together as industries and work together, or do we really segment? And the thing there is, the Department of Defense is focused on security at all costs.
Yep.
And so they are going to create things that feel like it's bringing collective security. And if no one from another industry engages with them and asks them questions ethically, technically, socially, morally, they are going to continue as an engine to do the thing that they do.
Yeah.
They will be better if other people get involved, because then we can have more perspectives on what it is that we're trying to do. And that is the biggest failing of not engaging with a problem at all, is that then you can walk away completely and you can criticize and you can judge for what they're doing, but you no longer have any impact on it. And the much harder thing to do is to say, maybe I don't feel totally right about what this is, but I'm going to sit there. I'm going to be part of it because I'm going to hope that my participation in that is going to make better, everything better. And that's the big risk of not being engaged.
Yeah. I've been giving a lot of thought to this as well, actually. And, you know, that's why I was just nodding and keeping quiet. Yeah.
I thought you were nodding and keeping quiet because my ideas were so great.
Well, no, but I've been thinking your ideas are cutting edge, right? But like, I've been thinking about this for years as well. And the major thing is actually the people that don't want to give their data away. The people that say, well, sorry, you can't use image recognition. That shouldn't be allowed. You can't use video analysis of people in airports, yeah? Which happens. We know that happens, yeah? Video analysis of people with AI in airports happens, guys. If people are listening to this and you don't know, yes, they're analyzing you. Why do do you think?
Your passport photo.
Right, but they're also analyzing people's movements, they're analyzing their behavior patterns, and that's based upon prior attacks and prior problems that have existed in the past. And this should be used in all cameras in all countries, yeah? And we would cut down the amount of problems. I'm sorry, but if you've got something to hide, yeah, then you don't want people to see your data and you don't want people to use your data and you don't want to be monitored. Yeah. If you've got nothing to hide, yeah, you don't have a problem, right? That's my particular opinion on it. I was talking to someone about it the other day. Yeah. And it's very easy to, he was saying how easy it is to actually track all of the data that goes through a particular server. You just put a thing around the cable and you can track any piece of data that goes out of there. Based upon whatever criteria you choose, right? So yeah.
I think that, so to me, yes, you're right. Then if anyone who's listening and doesn't know that is, I mean, you are being monitored already everywhere at all times. Yep. The amount is sort of socially how much we know about and how much we put our heads in the sand about. What is in, I think one of the things that's really interesting is it goes back to this question of sort of like, how do we want to be human? Like, what are the moral beliefs and sort of structures that we live on? And what do we think about them, right? And like, what is sort of freedom and free will? And what do we want the government to track and oversee? And like, the way that we have set up government is we are giving our citizenship to a nation in obeyance of their laws. Mm-hmm. And in the evolution of that time, we have sort of for any place, anywhere you live, we have found ways to get outside the laws. And the government has found more ways to ensure we stay inside the laws. And so that's actually what surveillance technology is. Now, you talk about it, and I kind of freak out about it, right? Like, I totally know where your position is. And yet I still think, I just don't want someone to know it. I have nothing to hide. I just don't want you to know all of my stuff all the time. But part of what that is like a very North American, very individualistic, sort of innate belief system that's built inside me from a culture that was based on, no, England, we don't want you to know what we're doing here all the time. We want to do it on our own, right? And so I think, so that culturally seeps into a lot of what we do in America. As a result, the government doesn't tell us about all of the things that we're doing. Mm-hmm. So we keep our head in the sands about it. And so I think what this comes to is this tension point, which is we have the luxury of having our head in the sands at all time. Should we? If we do want to keep our head in the sands about everything that is happening around us, then we shouldn't have anything to say about the direction of what happens.
True.
But if we want to stand up and pay attention, we should be able to engage in these debates and we should be able to ask a lot of questions, which is, are there places where we don't want to be monitored? Are there types of information that we don't want monitored? Are there types of privacies and protections that we don't want to just wholesale give away? I just wrote an article for Popular Mechanics the other day about the FBI app. So the FBI put out this like fitness app last year, and then they sort of have started promoting it again as people are staying home. The fitness app gives large scale permission essentially for the FBI to track you in anything. And why is that the default, right? Like, because we've not put any policy place to say a company should only have access to the bare amount of data necessary to run an app unless they have explicitly and clearly like made us give them approval to do it, right? Mm-hmm. Instead, we have a really lackadaisical approach to it, sort of a laissez-faire approach, which is, we'll take everything you want. And then like, if there's something that I find really concerning, I'll complain about it. And that's just because we don't want to pay attention to it, right? Yeah. And so I think it opens that question, opens up a lot of these big sort of debate questions about how do we feel? What do we want to do? And and really, how do we want to live our lives as a collective society? Yeah. Do we want to be monitored all the time or not? Yeah. And we already are. So have we already lost even the ability to negate that technological progress.
Agreed. There are, I mean, this conversation could go on for a long, long time, because you've got, I mean, there's bias in AI. There's bias in the machine learning. There, you know, then the ethics of, well, my 8-year-old daughter, when she goes onto Google and she looks at this, then how many advertisers know that she's been to these websites? And then they follow her around the internet knowing what she's done. Yeah. Like that was public years ago. Right. But did we do anything about it? No, because people in the technology business are further ahead than the government. Yeah. We look at the way that Trump was elected. We look at the way that Brexit happened. We look at the way the campaigns were run in a micro targeted approach with fear-based messaging. Yeah. And we step back and we go, oh, well, it all happened. And it's like, well, it happened because no one knew what the hell was going on, right? And actually the people that did had done it already before it even happened. Because in Parliament and in the government, right, we have people who, unfortunately, in the past haven't known anything about this kind of stuff. But I think now it's got a lot better. We've got a lot more expertise now that's readily on tap to the politicians, and they actually understand this. But will it give other candidates the powers to move the voters? Probably not, because they don't have access to the same people, the same expertise. So what's happening, I think, is that, you know, thankfully in America you're only allowed 8 years for a president, yeah. But these things are very worrying, yeah? Over here, I mean,
I think they're incredibly worrying everywhere, right? And I think, like, one of the points that you bring up that is, it's just really interesting. I was at a luncheon, like, 6 months ago with the head of the head of a company, and now I can't remember the name of it at the moment, but it's a big company. And he made the argument where he said, no one is letting the finance in.
Don't worry about it. It's all right. It happens to me all the time.
That's annoying. For some reason, I can't turn it off. Anyway, well, I was at this luncheon, and they were making the argument that, you know, we wouldn't let the finance industry self-regulate it. And it's something that so comes to me every time I think about the technology industry, which is the assumption that the technology industry has enough awareness of geopolitical, social, economic issues in order to even take an ethicist standpoint on what it is doing in the world is too much pressure. Like, it's too much pressure for us to put on an industry to assume that it actually has the ability and the foresight and enough learning to self-regulate.
They're not going to do that. They've got shareholders. I mean,
right. And there's a lot of greed, right? And there's a lot of, there's massive amounts of money. And in the same way that I don't expect some like 30-year-old investment banker on Wall Street to understand the geopolitical implications of, you know, shorting X, Y, and Z companies, I also don't understand why I assume that a 28-year-old developer in Palo Alto can employ an ethicist, and all of a sudden that one person can sort of help to ensure that technology is appropriate for society. And I think that's another case where technology companies need to go to Capitol Hill. They need to inform, or in all countries, right? You actually need to go there and you need to talk to the people who are making policy. So I went to Capitol Hill in August, and I talked about deepfake technology and cybersecurity.
Deepfakes. Yeah. I'm really interested in that as well, actually.
Love deepfakes. And I talked to the people who had up there's an AI caucus in the Senate. But it had only been around for 6 months, right? And so the legislative aide who's really on point for this, super smart guy, he's a history major, right? And so he with a big focus in science, marine science before this. And so he's really smart, incredibly capable of getting up to date on AI. But the people who are coming to meet him are all big companies with big lobbying agendas that have a bunch of opinions that they're pushing out. We went to Hypergiant, myself and our CEO, Ben Lamb, just to have a conversation about AI, because we're, you know, 250 people, so we don't have a massive lobbying agenda. We don't have a large enough, you know, need to do that at this point, but we wanted to talk to people because we care about the issues and we kind of wanted to see where people's heads were at. And more technology people who care should make an effort to talk to state and local level officials, to talk to national level officials, to ensure that the people who are making this kind of policy actually understand what, where we are with artificial intelligence. Like, I mean, I think there are people who think that there are computers out there who are thinking on their own and acting on their own, and that
people, you know, don't have a freaking clue. Like, it just, right. it's obscene. Like, do you realize how long it takes to just train one car to go around a racetrack? Like, it takes forever. Like, it's all segmented into tiny little boxes. And these people are just caught up with sci-fi novels and all this rubbish, yeah?
Interesting. So before the podcast started, you know, you and I were chatting and I told you that I am suffering from a traumatic brain injury, that I had a concussion in July. And it's really interesting to be working in AI where everyone's talking about, like, you know, future intelligence and that, you know, we're going to build these computers that are going to be smarter than humans and they're going to outthink us in all of these processes. And then to go and see a different neuroscience or a different, you know, neurology doctor or a neuropsych doctor almost every day of the week and ask them, well, why can't I remember things? Or why can't I remember specific words? Or why do I have these chronic pounding headaches? Or I developed a weird skill where I could remember very, very extremely long digits of numbers and find patterns in those numbers. And I was like, why is this happening? And they were all just like, we don't really know how the brain works. Like, we don't really know what a concussion is. Like, we don't really understand the science behind brain function. And so you look at those two things together and you just think of sort of this extreme hubris that we think we can develop a human brain without understanding the human brain. There's a lot of interesting work as well by the, I'm going to forget his name because of the concussion, the man who wrote, Escher, Gödel, and Bach, the like big sort of compendium on music and science and consciousness. Oh, it's very long. I actually have it right here on my shelf. Highly recommend it.
What's that called?
Oh, let me see it. I'm always got a book recommendation.
Eternal Golden Braid.
Oh, no. Gödel, Escher, and Bach.
Gödel, Escher, Bach. Okay. By Douglas what?
Hofstadter. Douglas Hofstadter.
Yeah.
And he was at, he's at Indiana University, and he talks about this idea of, like, if we could rebuild the brain, right? Like the actual, like, physical brain.
Mm-hmm.
Do we also build the mind? Like, do we build consciousness? And this is this argument with AI, which is like, oh, we're so scared that we're going to build it to a level that it's as smart as humans and then it will get consciousness.
Yeah.
But we don't understand consciousness, and we don't understand, like, what in the brain creates consciousness and what creates ethics and morals and feelings. True. And so how do we think that we're going to take something, AI, which is largely a pattern, like AI is patterns. Like, it's like, we teach something how to see patterns, like in chess, and then it figures out how to see all of those patterns and make all of the best moves.
Yep.
To a place where there's, like, contextual consciousness and the ability to make decisions outside patterns and sort of build all of these frames. I think we're so far off from that being an actually achievable thing. And yet we have these policymakers who are sort of inundated in pop culture understanding of AI, who believe, like, we should as policymakers be thinking about the potential, like the possible eventuality of that mm-hmm. scenario. But right now there's a lot of things that are like, deep fake technology is scary, not because AI is scary. Deep fake technology is scary because people are scary.
Yeah.
And so deepfake technology is a tool used by you know, people who can be malicious or have a malintent in order to swing elections, provide misleading propaganda about a pandemic, all of these things. That's what's scary, is we need to, politics is about understanding human actions and the tools that they can use and moderating those, like, access often in cases to those tools to be able to limit potential societal harm, right? And it's, that's where we need legislators to be a lot more smart, which is why we need to make sure that they know what we're doing, which is why we need to, I think, really develop much closer ties between technology and all other industries.
I agree. I mean, the major issue is also competition. I mean, competition is being reduced by the use of amazing technology. So people who are listening to this, if you're in business, you're in finance, you're a CEO, whatever, right? You need to be taking a look at what on earth's out there, because your business is just going to fall behind. And whilst this pandemic may be hurting you now, just watch. The businesses that come out of this really strong with great systems in place are the ones that are going to rock, right? And they're going to take it to the next level whilst your business dies. Like, sorry, but that's the reality of it, yeah?
I mean, 100%. That's even interesting from, like, a restaurant perspective, right? Like, all of these restaurants are going out of business. And you're like, okay, well, what does that show me, right? It shows me that restaurants are... they're a time and a place kind of thing, right? And so, like, as we change the way we operate, which, like, we will have to do things like meet the Paris Accords, like, people will have to work from home more. So they will cook more, they will spend more time at home, they will spend less time in restaurants, right? So, like, how do you either evolve the food offerings or the system offerings of your restaurant to sort of better prepare for a future world?
Like, take home?
Yeah, right. I mean,
come on.
But there's also other stuff, which is sort of like, how much of a restaurant is the experience of that dining? Well, what restaurant is giving me sort of a virtual dining experience, right? Like, would I be more keen to order takeout from a restaurant that is also sending me, like, this is the Spotify playlist that we would have put in the restaurant? Like, here's a candle with your takeout that
Good
is
idea.
Like, the scent of the restaurant. Here's, like, a little bouquet of flowers. So all of a sudden I'm buying the restaurant dining experience, and I'm probably willing to pay a bit of a premium because I'm at home.
Yep.
Like, really bored. I kind of want something different. Like, and takeout is seen not as like a luxury restaurant experience, but as like a necessity experience. But I'm home now, so I have more time. So I want, and would pay more for, which is like such a privileged Western person perspective, but like I would pay more for like a luxury or like elevated takeout experience. So like that's a great opportunity for someone who runs a business to understand the foundation of their business and not just change the distribution method, but to understand how to evolve that system in a new and changing world. And like that's honestly what everyone should be using this experience for, which is like, if you can't have a distributed workforce, then why not, right? Like, what, like, and what do you need to do to get towards a distributed workforce? Because we're not going to become less distributed. We're going to become more distributed, because there's, I mean, a lot of radical thinking about climate change, which is that, okay, no one thought these sort of radical measures were able to put in place to protect the planet. But now that we see that they are, so will we see some countries mandate continuation of quarantine methods because they're better for CO2 emissions? Because that actually will have a massive footprint, and we're already sort of habitualizing our way there. It's really interesting. We're working on a model, sort of a COVID quarantine plus climate change model, to look at how, what part of quarantining is having the biggest impact on CO2 emissions. And when we look at that, what lessons could we take to policymakers to say, hey, you know what is actually having a huge impact is the fact that office buildings aren't being lit, they aren't being heated, they aren't being X, Y, and Z things. Do we mandate for the next 10 years that all offices have, on Fridays, everyone in the entire country has to work from home, because it's going to see us be able to create a 15% reduction in carbon emissions, which means that mm-hmm. we are not also mandating people stop using fossil fuels or whatever they are, yeah. right? Like that's a bit extreme.
But I agree.
Lot of interesting things in that.
Yeah, loads, because you can look at all variables. I'm excited. I'm looking forward to hearing more about this from you next time we speak. Yeah, that'll be fun. Really good. Maybe we'll book another one in the diary once you've got some more tangibles to talk about from that.
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, it's super interesting. Yeah. Or we have a great climate change expert who's probably like, he's funny and interesting and like maybe a better.
He's more funny than you. Ooh. And more interesting than you.
Oh, much more interesting than me, but a different kind of funny.
Well, thank you.
He didn't pull a knife on me today, so.
Hey, no, we were talking about martial arts, and that's that. Thanks, Christina. Thanks for listening. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections too. And don't forget to drop us a review wherever you listen. Thank you.